The Right to Question is supported in part by the Paul Allen Family Foundation, by Humanities Montana, and by listeners like you.
What is Temple Grove?
Temple Grove is a grove of trees, old growth Douglas fir trees in the Olympic National Park of Washington State. They're trees that are 200 feet tall, 300 feet tall, between 500 years old and 1,000 years old. It would take maybe five or six people with their arms stretched out to circle the trees. It's a grove that's kind of in a disputed area. It may be in the national forest, and so if it's in the national forest, it's subject to being cut down, or it may be in the national park, and if it's in the park, then it should be protected. The Forest Service and the timber industry is claiming that there's been a surveying error, and so it's in jeopardy. And the timber companies found an independent contractor logger to get in and sort of start making the preliminary arrangements to cut down the trees. Then an environmental activist has decided to try to sabotage the cut in the Temple Grove. So it's this contested area, and a lot of different people in the book define the trees in different ways and think about the grove in very different ways.
Welcome to The Right Question, a program that features authors from the Western United States. I'm Cherie Newman talking with Scott Elliott about his most recent novel titled Temple Grove. The central characters in this novel are Trace and her son Paul. And while Trace is pregnant with Paul, you write that she feels buried beneath the weight of the story that seems permanently affixed to her in the small place where she lived. So tell us about Trace, her people, and this place where she lives, mm-hmm. where she feels buried mm-hmm. in the story.
Yeah. Trace is a macaw, and she lives in Nia Bay at Cape Flattery. It's the northwesternmost point in the lower 48 states. It's a small place where, and I think she says at one point that it's sort of this, people can level this sort of double-edged claim, you know, that I know you. And that can be good in the sense of having a community, but it sort of chafes when people know those things about yourself that maybe you want to sometimes escape. And we all have those kinds of things. And so Trace has this part of her story that she wants to get away from. And so she's thinking about leaving and finally does leave Nia Bay. She thinks first she wants to go to Port Angeles, which isn't too far away. It's sort of the city that people escape to from Nia Bay. It's a town that was originally a timber town and has maybe branched out and become something else. But it's about maybe 2 hours away from Nia Bay. And so that's where she goes to escape, to try to maybe to write her own story a little bit more, because she feels the encroachment of everybody knowing her story too much.
Mm-hmm. And especially since she's a very young woman, obviously pregnant, and no father in the picture.
Yeah, that's right. No father in the picture, and people know more than she'd like about the situation of the conception of that child, which was a rape on the banks of the Elwha River. She feels like she wants to get out of that situation.
Mm-hmm. And when you say she's a macaw, for people who mm-hmm. don't know the northwest area of Washington, Explain who her people are.
Yeah. The macaw are very much associated with the ocean and take pride, especially in the whale hunting of their ancestors. They sort of lived in this ingenious harmony with the ocean, you know, catching halibut and seals. And also whales, going out into longboats after whales, throw a harpoon and then use a seal skin sort of bladder to float and tire out the whale. They're interesting in Washington State because they're the southernmost of the Nuchalnuth people. So most of their cultural affiliation with other tribes is on the coast of Vancouver Island and going up north. And so great pride in the bravery it takes to go out after a whale in a small boat and be pulled along by the whale and really close affiliation with the ocean, especially.
It's hard to imagine that. What if the whale pulled you like halfway to Hawaii or something?
Yeah, and I think it happened. Yeah, in several days they'd be out after a whale. And then there'd be, of course, a big celebration when they returned.
Yeah. Well, as soon as he was old enough, Paul spent his summers working in the woods, and he spent what money he earned on equipment so he could spend more time in the woods. He was hiking and climbing mountains. And then eventually an environmentalist named Dan Kelso meets up with him and sees his passion for the woods and the environment and recruits him into some questionable activities. Mm-hmm. And there's a passage I'd like you to read about Paul. But before you do, just set it up a little. Give us some information about Uncle Jack and Dan Kelso.
Okay, yeah. I think Paul is sort of very much coming of age. In some ways, it's a coming of age story, and he's being pulled in different cultural directions, and he's trying to figure out who he is. Dan Kelso is kind of an old school monkey wrenching environmental activist who knew Edward Abbey and was involved in some environmental actions with him with Earth First. And he's taken on a new identity as a park ranger in the Olympic National Park and sees this and really values Paul's passion for the park. And Paul's sort of obsessed with the park, in part because he had this early sort of baptismal experience in the Elwha River where he miraculously survived this fall into the river. And somehow that's wound into him, and he feels like the place almost saved his life. And so he's very passionate about it. And Dan sees this in Paul and thinks it's a rare thing among this generation. He doesn't see it in many other people. And so he takes him under his wing and invites him into this action in the Temple Grove. And they're going to spike the trees to try and send out a communique to try to save them. Uncle Jack is Paul's great uncle, his grandmother's brother. And he's also had sort of a rocky past and had some things he's had to struggle with. But he's been saved in some ways by immersing himself in macaw culture and learning and going back to their family's dances. And he's taught Paul a dance that has to do with whaling and going down into the ocean and sort of this meeting place between worlds. And so they're sort of mentors. There's a way in which the book furnishes lots of father figures or possible father figures for Paul. And that's one of the things he's kind of, that they're all helping him in their own ways, but some of them are also perhaps putting him into harm's way. And so I think I'll go ahead and read this section in which Uncle Jack and Dan Kelso feature. Uncle Jack had said, "When you're up there in the woods, keep an eye out for spirits that might give you power. Since you're up there so much, there's a good chance you'll see something. Look out for things that should be by the shore, like a china cap or a crab heading into the woods. Look out for blind snakes, unusual colors on animals, anything strange. If you see something, respect it. Gather it up with something between you and it, or leave something in exchange for it, but only if you think it's worth taking on." Then he placed the portion of the spear tip wrapped in a purple felt crown royal pouch into Paul's hand and told him it might give him power, lend him the help of this ancestor who'd been a whaler. He looked into Paul's eyes and said, "Keep this close when you're out to country, preparing for the battles you need to fight when you're back in town." His conspiratorial manner had made it seem as if he knew what Paul was planning to do with Dan Kelso in the Temple Grove, as if he knew that Paul would soon need all the help he could get. During the height of the Temple Grove controversy, when Paul had tried to explain to his grandmother what was happening with the protests against the cutting of the old growth trees, she chuckled and asked, "Whose temple?" This made Paul think in a new way about the name the protesters and the earlier discoverers had given to the grove. The suggestion of a place of worship seemed apt given the solemn grandeur of the trees and the way the silence and the quality of the air seemed to push you toward a better self. Within that grove, standing in contemplation of the thousands of years the trees had stood silent witness, you felt more receptive to a higher power. It was no wonder that people read the presence of God or gods into the rich air and silence, the green and gold light filtering through the canopy. Just as his grandmother had made him question the idea of ownership and affiliation in the Temple Grove by asking whose it was, One of the protesters, a tall man whose name Paul never learned, had once pointed to his temple as he said the name of the grove. This in the middle of a conversation about the wide disparity in views among the constituencies involved. The simple gesture left Paul reeling in his contemplation of the implications of temple shifting to temple. The idea of a grove of trees named to honor the way what those trees meant shifted in accord with the interpretive and evaluative work going on in the brains between the temples of different beholders. Visits to the reservation had often shaken him out of his mainstream assumptions. Whose temple? Whose language? Whose boundaries? Whose land? Whose fish? Whose whales? What would it mean to rediscover and employ the macaw terms, older ways of seeing and identifying the trees? He did not know, nor did his grandmother or Uncle Jack, when he asked them what the macaw, who'd been so carelessly named in the official record, had called these trees, now known as Douglas firs because Scottish botanist David Douglas had introduced them to Europe. Discussions with his relatives on the reservation made him think about the arbitrary dynamics behind names, taught him that solid-seeming assumptions and conventions could be deconstructed, laid bare. The way the name of a man known for cultivating a tree might be applied to that tree, and how this naming carried with it a whole hierarchy of values for what one should attempt to do with one's life. What was deemed valuable might ignore, in name at least, thousands of years of interactions with the tree that had come to be called Douglas fir before the new name came into common use. He imagined that the macaw name for the tree might carry with it some sense of the tree's practical role, and he vowed to learn that name and the uses the macaw had had for the tree. Learning things like this was not always easy, as people had different ideas and recollections, told different stories about the old ways, which were often kept alive according to the idiosyncratic whims of the new interpreter, or irrevocably lost. His macaw relatives adopted a bemused attitude toward the ways of the Babafladithels, the Bucklids. That was part defense against a culture that dominated and threatened their own, and part critique of the folly of mainstream white ways, the ways of these people who'd come so late to the land and seemed to want to make up for their lateness by throwing tremendous energy and self-righteousness into grabbing power and changing everything. This is what his relatives seemed to think anyway when they weren't adopting mainstream ways themselves. Sometimes they juggled the worlds, integrating them or shifting between them. When Jack was still drinking and before he'd come back to macaw traditions, before he started singing and dancing again, he had pointed at the engine he was working on in his old gillnetter in the harbor at Nia Bay and told Paul and some of his cousins who were messing around on the docks that this engine was all he believed in and all that was worth believing in, internal combustion, well-oiled gears, turning piston. To hell with all that Indian mumbo-jumbo, he said so forcefully that Paul caught a whiff of his attempt to convince himself of something he didn't really believe. Keep on rocking in the free world was blaring from the speakers, and he was wearing a black and white AC/DC t-shirt. Put your energy into the logic of smooth-running engines, boys, he said. That's my advice, and he smiled his golden smile. These two Uncle Jacks were mirrored in Paul, who kept himself separate, most of the time leaning toward the mainstream, filtered through his love of the outdoors. He visited each self when it suited him, as if putting off a decision he assumed the world would one day force him to make. The sun rose with him up the ridge. By the time he'd reached the top, he was breathing hard and soaked with sweat despite the coolness of the morning. His arms and legs were scraped and bruised by the limbs and brush he'd had to clamber under and over. When he bushwhacked like this in the Olympics, he often thought of the Seattle Press expedition of 1889 and 90, one of Tom's favorite subjects and Paul's favorite stories. It had taken the six men on that expedition, who were sponsored by Seattle newspapers, 6 months to go 60 miles into this country, which at that time no white men had ever seen. Despite the historical lateness of the expedition due to the wilderness of the territory they were entering, some speculated their party might find an undiscovered tribe in the Olympic interior, a lost civilization sheltered by the mountains, carrying on the way they had for hundreds of years in a pristine valley, oblivious to what smallpox and the engine fueled by manifest destiny had done to those like them on the outside. In order to beat a rival expedition, the press party made the unfortunate decision of beginning their trip in December and of thinking they could raft up the Elwha's raging torrents. Paul loved the story because he loved any story in which the rugged wilderness foiled attempts to tame it. Paul's grandmother and Uncle Jack told a story about a peaceful gathering of many coast tribes in a valley deep in the Olympics, surrounded by mountains. Once a year, even warring tribes put down their weapons as they crested the peaks and went down into this valley to meet with the other tribes. One year, a giant named Sitko, who was taller than the tallest trees in the forest and who could travel by air, water, and land, came to the valley. While the tribes were gathered to engage in contest and to trade, he summoned a great earthquake that swallowed up many tribespeople. Those who survived warned other tribal members, and the tribes never gathered in the valley again. Even though he knew it was impossible, Paul sometimes imagined encountering in the deepest and remotest corner of the park, perhaps in the valley Sitko had attacked, a civilization oblivious after all these years to the rampant taming and trampling of all things wild outside the park. In these musings about a lost civilization, Paul saw himself throwing off all his connections to contemporary existence to join the tribe that, unlike his macaw ancestors, had avoided the blight, the rotting community-owned houses, the graffitied trailers overtaken by Himalayan blackberry and alder, the alcoholism, the depression and violence that he saw on his visits to Nia Bay. He hated the way these outward signs seemed so contradictory to the story the Cultural and Research Center wanted to tell about a past in which the macaw had lived in perfect, ingenious harmony with their natural surroundings for thousands of years. He sometimes thought of himself as the member of a new kind of tribe, somewhat dependent on technology, that would learn and teach others to respect and enjoy the natural world through close communion with its wonders.
You've been listening to Scott Elliott read from his most recent novel, Temple Grove. We'll be back shortly to talk about technology, nature, mythology, and sources of confusion about American Indian cultures. Please stay with us. It occurred to me after I read that passage that we don't often think of technology and nature as coinciding. We don't think about the river that was dammed so we can plug in our cell phone. So this idea of nature and technology in harmony, I was wondering what that would look like.
Yeah, well, something that I think a lot of the characters in this novel are struggle with, and I think a lot of people who enjoy the outdoors are confronted with. I mean, the idea, especially if you're driving your car, you know, great distances to go get away from people and find some kind of, in quotes, maybe say pristine natural place. And Paul, I think, is of a generation, and there are some other characters who are kind of a foil for him in this book that are very taken with their screens and with video games especially. And so he's a little bit different from that, but I think he also is recognizing, and he carries an MP3 player with him and listens to music while he's outside, and listens also to the wailing song that his Uncle Jack gave him. There's also a moment where his stepfather, who's sort of serving as another one of these possible father figures for him in the book, says, "How can you live well and live with yourself?" You know, this idea of needing to participate in the economy and make a living, but also, you know, feeling bad about the work he does. He runs these old ships aground at the Alang Beach in India because it's too expensive to dispose of them properly in the United States. And so there are a lot of characters, I think, coming up against this idea. There's also, of course, the dams on the Elwha River are coming down now. During the time of the book, they're still up. And at one point, the characters notice the dams and remember how the great big king salmon came up the Elwha and banged their heads against the dam trying to get upstream to spawn. And that was, of course, built, the lower Elwell Dam was built to power a pulp mill in Port Angeles. The book is really interested in gauging some of these tensions, at least raising these questions.
Other tensions that are apparent in the book are the Indian characters really resent the assumptions that non-Indians make about them. Mm-hmm. And I was curious what your take is on what do Paul and his mother want from non-Indians?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's a good question. I think there's a way in which they sort of don't want to have to be representative have the pressure of speaking for their people. I think that's part of what's going on with them at various moments. Paul especially, I think, he's still coming of age. He's trying to forge his identity. I think Trace is trying to find her place. They're both in this kind of liminal space. Trace has grown up with the Macaw way of engaging with the sea and knowing the names of things in some of these traditions. And then she later looks at the Marine Science Center, works there working with a Pacific octopus who's a character in the book and takes care of the animals at the Marine Science Center and knows the names of things, the scientific names. And so I think there's a way in which they maybe don't want to have to speak for or to be looked to translate these things in the white sphere that they move in.
As Paul noticed in that passage you read, there's a confusion even among tribal members about here's how we used to be and here's our culture that we're trying to preserve, but that's not how we live today. We don't go out in canoes and hunt whales. And also the idea that all people try to generalize other people. So that was really a great point in the book.
Yeah, well, thank you. Yeah, I think taking people as the complex sort of not reducible person that we all are. Yeah, I think that's part of what's going on. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I just thought I detected a whiff of Greek mythology in here. Is there a little bit of that going on?
Yeah, well, I wanted to write a sort of a big story that took a big swing and it maybe had some of the exaggerations of that you might find in a Greek myth. I thought of this in a mythical way. You know, the idea of at one point I alluded to Paul's baptism in the Elwell River. Trace takes him in up the Elwell River Trail and onto a bridge, and it's somewhat of an accident, but maybe not. It drops him into the Elwell River and is thinking that she'll be rid of him and then rushes to save him. And I also bring up at the end, I very explicitly bring up the Odyssey. And it was really interesting to me to think about when Homer was writing the Odyssey, and also to think about maybe the Macaw people in their own canoes going across the wine dark sea. So I like that juxtaposition. One story that perhaps from Western culture we know so well or is better known, and then the other side that's maybe been actively at one point in our country's history sort of repressed and if not, you know, an attempt to stamp it out. So I was interested in writing something that seemed mythical, that was that seemed almost exaggerated in that way that Greek myths are. This father and son who don't know their father and son, you know, bringing them into contact with each other. And it's somewhat risky, I suppose, to do that in our postmodern age or in an age where literary fiction shies away from coincidences like that. And so I wanted to sort of steer right into the face of that risk.
I think those elements gave it a possibility for a deeper reading. Mm-hmm. So you could read this as a fiction story and be entertained, or you could look in a little deeper and say, I want to think about this some more. I want to find out more about what myth is connected with this part of the story. Mm-hmm. So I think it made it more interesting.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. There's also the sense of exaggeration in cultural spaces, like the space of logging. There's some kind of tall tale-esque passages in which characters, especially the logging character, Paul's father, Bill, the logger, performs feats that are a little bit beyond what we might expect somebody could actually accomplish. And in his some of their relatives especially, there's some stories there that have clearly been exaggerated, and that may be a sort of a Paul Bunyan logging tall tale tradition. And so I was thinking about lots of different sort of mythic spaces, and including, you know, the way that we define land as, you know, as it's a place, I think, the Olympic National Park, that's given to this sort of mythic way of thinking about things, with these big trees and all this rain and this verdant growth. There's a Richard Hugo poem that I like that says, "Moss that hangs on maples like disease." And so there's this way in which I think the place lends itself to that. And it seems like it's an accurate way somehow of engaging with the place to bring up this kind of mythic. But it's also our sense, of course, the earliest reason for myths is a way to explain things and a way to maybe explain the mysteries of a place. At one point in the book, a character says, or the narrator says, that it's a palimpsest of different human stories and even what seems like wilderness. And so there are these Native American legends and stories about settlers who tried to live in a place, but it didn't work out. And a guy named Cougar Mike who lived there, and you might think, well, how did he get that name? And stories about the Solduck River being tears of a dragon that battled another dragon and then went off to its own valley to cry. And so it's wonderful to start to see all these ways that people have tried to explain the place through stories and map those onto the place. And sort of there's this richness in that, I think. But then also, when you're writing a novel, of course, you're making your own new myth, your own new story about it that you hope will maybe join that palimpsest in some way. And I'm fond of just finding the novel as a kind of magpie's nest in which you sort of take these little disparate pieces and you bring them together and try to sew them together into something that feels whole. And I think that was one of the little pieces. And then there were a lot of other little pieces. These central experiences were another piece. And then later I started to research by going to places that I wrote about in the novel and also reading people who'd written about the peninsula. I mentioned Richard Hugo earlier, his poems about the peninsula. He has a great poem called "The Map of the Peninsula." That's actually about trying to write about the peninsula that ends, you know, "Soak this map in rain, and when the cheap dye runs, only glacier and river names remain." So about the sort of the difficulty of writing about this place that has these big storms pouring over it and all this water coming off of the Pacific Ocean that somehow makes it seem mysterious and inaccessible and difficult to capture on the page. I think of it as a novel in some ways of redemption for characters. The image that's ended up on the covers of this nurse log, you know, a log that's been cut down with a little shoot coming up out of it. And so I think it's a novel about losing what you thought was going to be your life and having your life take an unexpected turn, and a turn that maybe seems unfortunate, but about the way that becomes a gift, perhaps, and your struggles in those moments, the way that they become something that maybe defines you in the best possible way.
Scott Elliott teaches at Whitman College in Walla Walla, Washington. Look for more information about him, as well as links to our podcast and Facebook page at mtpr.org/TWQ. I'm Cherie Newman, wishing you a pile of fascinating books and lots of questions.
The Right Question is produced by Cherie Newman, with help from Barbara Thoreau and Kim Anderson. Michael Marsalek, executive producer. Beth Ann Austin, studio engineer. Music for this program was written and performed by John Floridis. The Right Question has a Facebook page, a blog, and a podcast. You'll find links to all that at mtpr.org/TWQ. Thanks for listening and for supporting this program.